step inside a grand church in Paris on a sunny afternoon to see for yourself why it's called the City of Light.
Suddenly, the sun came out, and it came through the clerestory windows, which are up at the high point of the cathedral, and it was dazzling.
Marvel at a rare celestial event on the winter solstice in one of Ireland's most sacred ancient sites. If you're one of the lucky few, you might get to witness it from inside the burial chamber at Newgrange.
The central chamber was always in darkness, you see, and then when the sun would go in, a laser beam of light would go up the central chamber and illuminate it.
Walk through magical holiday lights in the streets of Rome.
The lighting displays, they get more beautiful and more ornate, and every year is a little bit different.
And take a look at Christmas traditions in Venice and in Estonia. Step into the light with us in the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. As the days of December darken and the temperatures dip, it's no wonder that so many winter traditions invoke light and warmth. Coming up today on Travel with Rick Steves, an Irish friend tells us how he was able to enter inside Ireland's Newgrange burial mound on the winter solstice to await the illumination from the rising sun, much like people did more than 5,000 years ago. Fred Plotkin invites us into the steamy comfort of a traditional sauna, the way they do it in Finland. And we'll wander through Christmas markets in Tallinn before heading to Venice and Rome for some holiday light displays. Paris has some amazing churches. You can view them as historic buildings with impressive architecture. You can view them as great places to go for a concert with wonderful acoustics. Or you might regard Paris's venerable places of worship as quiet refuges where you can escape the hubbub of the streets and take a moment to get close to God. Susan Cahill has identified 30 great churches, as well as synagogues in Paris and the city's Grand Mosque, as a way to showcase the city's spiritual, artistic, and cultural history. She joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to talk about what she features in her book. It's called Sacred Paris, a guide to the churches, synagogues, and the Grand Mosque in the City of Light. Susan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Paris is the City of Light. What does that mean to you?
Well, in the very early church in the 3rd century, they considered light the presence of God. So God was light. And that's the first line in the Gospel of St. John. And actually, it made sense to me because when I walked into the Cathedral of Saint-Denis in northern Paris, suddenly the sun came out and it came through the clerestory windows, which are up at the high point of the cathedral. And it was dazzling. I could hardly see. And I understood how they felt that way.
And Susan, people got to remember that the Basilica of St. Denis is where Gothic architecture was basically invented,
that's
right?
It.
By Abbot Suger.
Absolutely, right.
So that's 800 years ago. And the big deal about Gothic is what? How was Gothic different from Romanesque?
Well, for one thing, it was constructed so that the light would come in. It wouldn't be blocked by thick stone walls. And there were many more windows, and they highlighted just the fact of the architecture with color. So it was absolutely different from Romanesque, which was the early church architecture.
You know, I often think about that, Susan, if I was a Christian going to church in 1100, the church would be dark. And you could hardly read because it's so dark. And
right,
so
right.
It must have been so dazzling to have light coming into the churches. And when we go to these great places of worship, these churches in Paris, where are some moments? If you're walking around Paris, it's a great city for walking around. You stumble into a church you didn't even know the name of and you go, whoa, what a discovery. Your book is a great handbook for somebody who's going to be walking out in the streets and stumbling into these churches. What are a couple churches that really struck you as, whoa, more people should check this place out?
Well, my favorite church is Saint-Germain-des-Prés. Saint-Germain, he was a bishop, Des-Prés of the Fields, because it was open country back then. And it was founded in, I think, about the 7th century. And then it has changed, and now they've just done a massive reconstruction, and it's absolutely gorgeous. They've also found some 12th century statuary in garbage dumps nearby. And the thing that they found that just stuns me is a statue of this, the Virgin and the Smile, Sourire. It's stunning. And they keep changing its location in Saint-Germain-des-Prés, I think, to show it off at its best.
Ah, you know, I love this idea about approaching Paris as a collection of surprises and discoveries.
Yes, absolutely.
And the city is speckled with these churches. They're open, they're free, and they're filled with surprises. When you think, as you research your book, tell me just a surprise that hit you when you stepped into a church.
Well, I was told that Saint-Germain-de-Chéron, which is out in Chéron, it's not actually a suburb. It's just on the edge of Paris. It has paintings, and that's one of the things. Le Monde ran an article about, during the pandemic, churches were the place to go to see art because all the museums were closed. But the churches were open, and their art is spectacular. You know, they've got Delacroix, they've got Tiepolo, they've got Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, it's incredible to see, and I never expected it. So that is a big surprise.
So art can be a surprise when you step into a church?
Yes.
Music can be a surprise also. What's a musical moment you've enjoyed in a church
Paris? Well, their best concerts, and you know, featuring the Orchestre de Paris and the great choirs, have been for special holidays and feast days. For instance, the Verdi Requiem was sung and played for the anniversary of the end of World War I, November 11th, 1918. So I saw it 2018. I couldn't believe it. For one thing, the acoustics of these old churches are magnificent. And this rendition of Verdi's Requiem, I've heard it in New York, but I never heard it like this. And Paris, they sit still. They don't cough. You do not see a phone. And at the end, they just clapped and stood and were so happy. Another one that had the same kind of electricity was the anniversary of D-Day. There was not an empty seat, and in fact, it was held in Saint-Eustache, which is a very large church. It was filled.
You know, you need to take initiative to find out about those events, those concerts, those special services. I mean, you can find that online.
Absolutely.
You can find it in the Periscope. One of my favorite musical moments was in Saint-Sulpice, and after the Mass, traditionally, a little door in the back of the church opens up, and organ lovers can scamper up the spiral staircase and go into the organ loft.
Yes.
And actually be there with the organist as he performs a little concert between the Masses. And talk about acoustics.
All of them.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Susan Cahill, and we're exploring the great religious architecture of Paris. She's identified about 30 places of worship that she writes about in her book, Sacred Paris. I was talking, Susan, about surprises, and there's a little church just across the river from the Notre Dame on the left bank in a park right next to the oldest tree in Paris.
Oh, I
think
know
you
that.
Know the church I'm talking about.
Right.
The church of Saint-Julien-le-Pauve.
Yes.
And I've walked into that church many times, and it's usually been very quiet and lifeless, frankly.
Yeah.
And on my last visit, I walked in, and it was filled with incense and candles and mystery. And then I realized it's been adopted by the Eastern Orthodox community in the city.
Right.
And now it's filled with life. And it reminded me, we need to step into these churches to appreciate them.
I agree. I put in my book the Russian Orthodox Church, St. Alexandra Nevsky, which is up in the 8th arrondissement. And it was...
So that's near the Arc de Triomphe.
Exactly, right. And I have to say, there were times when that was my favorite because it was so reverential. It was very quiet, but there were plenty of people there. And I was shocked by how mystical that felt. And I'm not looking for that.
If you put yourself in the mindset of somebody from a different denomination or a different religion altogether, it can really be a great travel experience. In Paris, you also featured synagogues and the Grand Mosque. Tell us just briefly about the synagogues in Paris and then the mosque.
There are quite a few synagogues, and I chose two. One is the oldest, La Victoire, on Rue de la Victoire. But I was shocked because I had been warned in New York, they'll never let you in, you have to be Jewish, da-da-da-da-da. Well, I got there on a Friday night for Shabbat, and other people, we were all waiting, we became friends. And then the usher came in, asked where we were all from. New York, the greatest city in the world. I thought, wait a minute, buddy, we're standing in the greatest city of the world. But he didn't check our pocketbooks. He didn't take our passports. We just went in. And the liturgy was so gorgeous. And the place is ravishing. It has, you know, those deep blue windows like they have in Notre Dame, and gold everywhere, red velvet liners on the pews, white marble gleaming, and all these happy people. Nobody looks sad in a synagogue. And then I went to another one, Nazareth, which is the oldest synagogue on Rue de Nazareth near République, smaller than La Victoire, but it's so pretty and charming. But they did interrogate me at the tour. They kept saying, are you Jewish? Are you Jewish? And I have to say I lied because I really wanted to see this synagogue. And not only that, I'm a New Yorker, lifelong. All New Yorkers are part Jewish. That's what we all tell one another. So it was a joke, and they knew I was lying, and it was funny, and they offered me some of the Kaddish. But it's charming, a beautiful place, but not as big and as grand as La Victoire. But this beautiful place that is still in action, and people are still going there. And you can tell they're proud to go there. I just loved it.
Susan Cahill is the author of Sacred Paris. It's an illustrated neighborhood guide to the city's grandest religious architecture. She's also written Hidden Gardens of Paris. And her book, The Streets of Paris, follows famous Parisians through the city's history. Her website is susancahill.net. That's spelled C-A-H-I-L-L. You know, Susan, when I was paging through this book, and it's just so full of little insights inspiring me to want to go back to Paris and pop into some of these churches, I was almost sort of jealous thinking how much time you've had to be able to go into these churches and appreciate them. What is one moment, one magical, spiritual, or personal moment you've had in a church in Paris?
Well, this was not exactly, I don't know if you call it a church, but it's a sanctuary. I was just blown away when I walked into the mosque, the Grand Mosque. It is so beautiful. It is stunning. It's turquoise tiles and water flowing everywhere, palm trees up to the ceiling. Everyone reverential, no one shouting, and that really did stir me. I don't know that much about Islam, but the place when you walk in, and just you want to know more.
And it's impressively welcoming.
Yes.
To people who are just kind of curious, people that don't know much about Islam, and you're welcome to go in. There's a garden, there's a tea room nearby.
Right.
It's near the Institute of the Arab World. It's a fascinating dimension of Paris that I think savvy travelers, thoughtful travelers, recognize is an important part of Paris. Susan, I wish we had more time, but we've got to wrap it up. I want to thank you for writing Sacred Paris, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we'll find the light of the winter solstice at Newgrange in Ireland, and we'll warm up in a Finnish sauna and get you in the Christmas spirit like they do in Italy and Estonia. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Our favorite pleasure activist, Fred Plotkin, helps us shake off winter's chill at a Finnish sauna in just a bit. And we'll start out our holiday season in Estonia and Italy. But first, let's stop over in Ireland to observe the solstice. The sun is once again the star attraction, if you'll pardon the pun, every winter solstice at Newgrange in Ireland's Boyne Valley. It's a burial mound created thousands of years ago during the Stone Age. It was designed to allow the angle of the sunrise on the winter solstice to enter as a shaft of light right into its burial chamber. Stephen McPhillamy takes dozens of tour groups to Newgrange every year. He was selected to be one of a handful of people who actually got to go inside the burial chamber on the morning of the winter solstice. Stephen's here to tell us what happened.
Thanks, Rick.
Explain to us what Newgrange is, actually. I mean, I gave a little quick overview there, but what's the story about this amazing site that's just about an hour outside of Dublin?
In my opinion, it's the blockbuster site in Ireland. It's 5,000 years old. We like to always remind visitors that it's even older than the pyramids and older than Stonehenge. It's 1 hour from Dublin, and it's this glorious big mound of earth and rock on top of a hill that stands out, and it's got this beautiful white front. You can spot it from 2 miles away as you're approaching it. Just a very popular visitor attraction, but it's 5,000 years old. Our ancient ancestors used to believe that on the morning of the winter solstice, as the sun would go in, this central chamber was always in darkness, you see. And then when the sun would go in, a laser beam of light would go up the central chamber and illuminate it. And there's these big stone urns inside that used to contain the ashes of our dead cremated ancestors. And as the sun would go back down the chamber, we believed, our ancestors believed, that the sun would take the souls of our ancestors to the next world.
Whoa.
With them.
So 5,000 years ago, this was designed knowing there'd just be a few minutes out of the year when the ray of sun would come in, illuminate the burial chamber, and as it crept in, it brought access to eternal life, and then as it crept away, it took the souls of those. Would that just be any Sean or Paddy, or would that be actually leaders or kings or something like this?
Because 5,000 years ago in Ireland, we have no records or any written records of what. You can only guess, but you'd imagine that anybody who got to be buried inside Newgrange must have been a pretty prominent chieftain or king or queen of a spiritual leader. The sun moves on then, of course, and it returns to darkness inside for 365 days of the year. And this has been going on for 5,000 years. So it's only 8 minutes. There's only 8 minute window of opportunity for it to be lit inside.
But now if it doesn't happen, it's because it's cloudy. And in Ireland, that's more likely than not.
Exactly. So on the day that I went there during the lottery.
So first of all, there's actually a lottery, and tell us what that is.
Yeah. So every year, around 40,000 people apply. And when you go to visit the burial chamber at Newgrange, the visitor centre there, there's a nice little box and it says if you wish to be picked to come here on the winter solstice, write your name down and put it in the box. So I've been to Newgrange with tours probably 50 times and I've applied a lot and I never ever expected to win. But on this occasion this year, actually, my bus driver, Dennis McArdle, I'll have just to give a shout out to him, he asked me what I was doing when I was filling out the form. I said, I'm filling in the form to win the lottery to get to Newgrange. And I said, you should do it as well. I suggest you apply as well. So he applied. It was actually him that won.
Yeah.
So he invited me to come along because he had never heard of it
before.
So
you get to take your favorite buddy with you.
Two people get to go and only 20 people get selected to be inside out of 40,000.
40,000. So you've got a lucky bus driver.
Yeah. And for me, like, people sometimes say, oh, you should have played the lottery that week.
Yeah.
And for me, this was better than winning the lottery because you can't buy access to Newgrange on the winter solstice.
That was priceless.
For me, it's absolutely
so
priceless.
So you were there with 20 people.
20 people inside. They switch off the lights and it's complete darkness. You can't see a thing. And there's 20 voices there sort of whispering and nervously saying this and that. And there's an archaeologist there and she's explaining what's about to happen. And there's a really dramatic build-up. And she's saying, you know, any minute now, at 9:02, the sun is going to come up and it's going to illuminate and we will see each other's faces because there will be this brilliant golden light. She said, nobody look at your watches. No one turn on any phones. So we didn't know what time was, but nothing actually was happening. We could see the light come in at the bottom of the chamber a little bit. We're standing in the central chamber, which is about 10 metres from the door. Eventually, I suggested that the time had passed, and she took a look at her watch, and the time had passed. Nothing actually happened that morning because it was too cloudy.
So you won the lottery, and you got up early, and you're there with 20 people in the middle of this big 5,000-year-old stone mound, and nothing happens. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Stephen McPhillamy about his experience celebrating the winter solstice, whether it's sunny or not, at Newgrange.
Nothing happened, but there was people there from Mexico. There was two people there from the Netherlands. Imagine traveling all the way from Mexico to that chamber and nothing happened. But the point is, people said to me, were you disappointed? And I just did not feel any sense of disappointment whatsoever because it just almost felt perfect because that's what may have happened 5,000 years ago.
Yeah.
You can't predict how nature's going to be.
Right.
And I just really felt part of something enormous.
And it caused you to respect what happened 5,000 years ago. We have no idea how sophisticated these people are. We only guess what they were building and what they were thinking and why.
Yeah, and I like to put myself in the shoes of my ancient Irish ancestors and think, how would they have felt that day when the people left the central chamber and said to the people outside, the gods did not speak to us. The universe has not spoken to us this year.
So you'll have to wait. Maybe there's a lesson in that. Oh, wise one, be patient.
I took some crystals with me because I have a friend who's a druid back in Ireland. And she was really overjoyed for me that I got selected. And she said, I have one request. And she said, would you take some crystals into the chamber for me?
To charge them up?
To get them charged up and energized with the sun. So I wasn't skeptical that the sun was going to come in, but I just didn't want to take a chance. So I left them down at the front door so that they definitely would get hit with the sunshine. So I had a huge, big, long obelisk of crystal, of quartz, and I had about 10 other little small pieces, and they were energized and blessed. And I actually have one to present to you just here.
You got one?
So this is a piece of crystal, rose.
And this has been energized by the sun at Newgrange?
In Newgrange.
As has been going on for 5,000 years?
Yes.
I will take this and I will put it in my top drawer and I will probably forget it.
That's okay. But just before you do that, just hold it. And it's all about intention.
It's intention. Okay, I will hold this.
It may bring you some very positive energy.
Stephen McPhillamy, this is something I'm thankful for because American travelers can go to Newgrange, 1 hour north of Dublin now. They can make reservations online and they can go to visit this amazing edifice almost any day of the year without winning the lottery.
Absolutely. And they have a little light system that replicates the...
They do.
The winter solstice
anyway.
So you could
use your... It's intention.
Yeah.
Stephen McPhillamy, it's always good to talk to you and connect a little bit with the beautiful and evocative Emerald Isle.
Thanks, Rick.
Stephen McPhillamy's website is stephenmcphillamytravels.com. When I was in Finland, my guide took me to the rooftop of a restaurant with a nice balcony overlooking the town, and below me on the roof just across the way, there was the top floor of a business, and it was filled with well-fed businessmen cooked like red lobsters in their sauna. And she said, every business provides a sauna. I realized later that at the National Finnish Opera House, there's two saunas that are kept fired up all the time for musicians and patrons of the arts to enjoy a little soak. I'm joined by Fred Plotkin for an insight into the sauna of Finland. Fred, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
When I was talking about that little introduction to the sauna, what was your response? Is it Finnish? Is it Swedish? Why is it such a big deal?
Well, it was born in Finland, and sauna to them is sacred, and I mean that very seriously. In ancient times, childbirth took place in the sauna because it was warm and it was hygienic. When people died, they were dressed for burial in the sauna. There is an expression in Finland, first build the sauna, then build the house, because the sauna is what is life-giving. People can often keep food in there. It is the place where everything is maintained through the cold winters, and it's the place where you clean yourself, and then after that you go for a dunk in the Baltic, in a swimming pool, in the shower, and assuming you don't have a heart condition, that is the best thing to do. Anyone who goes to Helsinki should go to the Finnish Sauna Society, where you can learn about the different types of sauna, 5 degrees of humidity, the cold soaks, the hot soaks, and then the pièce de résistance, you can be scrubbed. You have not lived until you've had a kindly old Finnish woman scrub you like you're a little baby, and you feel so content after that you go right to sleep. The best sleep of your life.
Now, Fred, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I'm trying to analyze the economics of the sauna. And my hunch is, in a less affluent time, there were more public saunas. And today, in an affluent age, when the tourist goes to Finland, the saunas that he or she will be able to enjoy are either in the hotel or on the cruise ship coming in. But most people are wealthy enough to have a sauna in their home. Consequently, there's not so many corner saunas anymore, but if you go to a poorer or a working class neighborhood in the suburbs away from the center, that's where you might find a traditional public sauna.
There are a few left. My favorite is Ironkatu, right in the middle of Helsinki from 1928. But there's another one called Kotiharju, which is a wood-fired sauna, the last one that's public in Helsinki. And this is where working class people go. Because once upon a time, they did not necessarily have showers in their homes, so they went to clean themselves at the public sauna. There is no whiff of sexuality the way there is in lots of other countries with sauna. To the Finns, it's purely something about hygiene, about pleasure, about relaxation.
Now, I took the bus out to Kotiharju one afternoon, and it was quite a powerful, interesting experience for me. There wasn't any English there. It was definitely a working-class, functioning sauna filled with people who were there to do their soak and their relaxation. And I went in, and I remember being kind of awkward. I felt sort of like a naked Woody Allen without his glasses. And I was sitting on this concrete step surrounded by steam and knotty wood paneling and rusty railings and naked Finns. And everybody had long, stringy blonde hair pasted to their face. And I remember looking out and thinking, wow, I have no idea what century I'm in, but it's definitely Finland. It was a fascinating, wonderful experience.
It's genuine. And in a time when so many things are created as prepackaged experiences, when you find something genuine, you do everything you can not only to be a part of it, but do everything you can to save it. These are landmarks that are part of our culture, not just Finnish culture, but world culture.
And then afterward, I decided, in the spirit of Fred Plotkin, to embrace the sensuousness of it all, to get that rub down you talked about. And this woman who was wearing like a fisherman's plastic bib, she put me on her table. I felt like a salmon being gutted. She knew how to hold my slippery arm with all the suds and so on, so she could pull me up and scrub me. Dirt was coming off me in Tootsie Rolls with her Brillo pad mitts. And she worked me over, and I can't explain how relaxed and clean I felt after that. That's the scrub down you're talking about?
Yes, but also as Americans, we're taught to be in control of our situations. Everything we learn in school is about control, and this is about giving up all control and just being completely treated as an object of love and affection and not having any means of giving it back. You just give in and you feel blissful. There's no other way to say it.
You know, that's a very interesting concept, giving up control. There I was. I mean, naked. Everybody was naked there. I'm laying on this big wooden picnic table, and this woman, who's just very strong and knows what she's doing, just works me over. And I just said, all right, here I go. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. When in Finland, let's go to the sauna.
The Romans wouldn't do that, I assure you.
Well, when you go to Finland, you've got an experience waiting for you. We would recommend that particular sauna, I think. Kotiharju.
Kotiharju. But also the Finnish Sauna Society, which is just outside of town and reachable on public transport, is another one that maintains that tradition.
I guess if you're going to do a sauna in Finland or Sweden, you would go Finland?
Yes.
All right. Fred Plotkin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's towel off now and take a short hop from Helsinki across the Baltic Sea to Tallinn in Estonia. That's where guidebook author Neil Taylor is preparing to celebrate Christmas with his Estonian wife and her family. While Estonians have enjoyed independence since 1991, after centuries of rule by neighboring empires, their history has brought them a festive mix of traditions for the holidays. Neil, Merry Christmas. Tell us what's unique about Christmas in Estonia.
Not quite unique in the sense that a lot of the dishes are inherited from the German times, as it were. The Germans brought culture in many ways and they brought cuisine. The differences are that people eat on Christmas Eve, that's the main meal, and it also has to bear the Soviet era in mind, because, of course, you couldn't celebrate Christmas publicly in the 50 years of the Soviet regime.
But if you were a communist during... enthusiastically communist during the communist times, how would you celebrate the winter festival, which for a lot of people, that's all Christmas is? Was there another kind of permissible festival?
Well, St. Nicholas Day and the Russian Orthodox Christmas in January the 6th. And if you were really brutal, you would go round to the churches on the 25th to see who was celebrating Christmas in a religious sense. And you would sort of see which parents were taking their children there, which adults were just breaking away from the family to be seen, as it courageously to be seen, in a church on the 25th.
So that was a kind of civil disobedience.
It was, yes, yes.
Oh, my
I mean,
you were
spotted. They couldn't arrest people because, of course, said there's religious freedom in Estonia, so they couldn't just storm into a church and seize whoever is there. But it was noted who was attending.
So what are the childhood memories now in the days of freedom? Estonia's been free for more than 30 years. What are the fun things that kids in Estonia look forward to on Christmas?
Well, they actually look forward to a very Western Christmas, shall we say, as a complete break from Soviet times. And consumerism has its part in that. From the 90s, everyone was very excited that you could go to the shops and buy things, and also seeing Christmas on Finnish television as they'd done for ages before. So wide ranges of presents, and of course the children being more and more demanding. That is mirrored in Estonia too, and businesses take advantage of that.
I would think, you know, Tallinn is sort of a fairy tale town. It's just like a medieval dream come true in so many ways. I would think the Christmas markets that are such a hit in Germany would be a big deal in Tallinn. It's just perfect for a Christmas market.
It is, and the things are locally made now. There was a time when they were importing massively from Russia and from China. Well, that, of course, has all come to a halt now. So if you buy a toy in the Christmas market in Tallinn, a wooden toy, it will have been made in Estonia, and that is tremendous, and there's a wide choice as well. Of course, they've got the Glühwein, which comes from the German tradition, and then the cakes, which are now coming from the Western tradition, the Christmas pudding and the Christmas cake.
Neil, what is your Estonian wife's name?
Tina.
Tina. Well, when you celebrate Christmas with Tina in an Estonian way, just a last thought, what is the dish that you look forward to?
Well, it's pork and sauerkraut, which I can't say I really look forward to, so I'm not allowed to cook it at all. I'm cast aside before that's taken on Christmas Eve. And potatoes as they are. The Estonians say, well, we grow lovely potatoes. We don't need to do special things with them. I mean, we tend to roast them, boil them, mash them, do all sorts of things with different herbs. But the Estonians would say, well, our potatoes we can enjoy intact.
Pork, sauerkraut, and potatoes.
Yes.
Okay, come on. There's got to be a little sweet capper. What would be the dessert?
Oh, there would be sort of, I mean, the Christmas pudding now, and dishes with apples, because they grow lots of apples. So
apples.
A very generous apple crumble, apple pie, ice cream, which you could say is more of a Russian tradition perhaps than a German one, but it makes a sweet more substantial, and that is important, that you have three heavy dishes. So you've got the thick soup, you've got the pork and the sauerkraut, and then you've got the pies to finish up with.
It's as Estonian as apple pie with ice cream.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Well, Merry Christmas in Estonia, Neil Taylor, and I hope that you and Tina have a great time.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Rick.
Neil Taylor writes The Brat Guide to Estonia, and his book Estonia, A Modern History is now in its third edition. Up next, guides from Venice and Rome join us to share what they're looking forward to this Christmas in Italy. We're getting into the holiday spirit today at Travel with Rick Steves. In just a bit, listeners share some of the winter haiku they've written for us. But first, on Christmas Eve, people around the world tune in for the telecast of the Midnight Mass from St. Peter's Basilica. But nothing beats being in Rome for Christmas in person. For a taste of the Roman holiday, we're joined now by Kenny Dunn. He's an American from Philadelphia who moved to Rome back in 2009. He soon fell in love with the culture and the food, and today he runs a food tour business called Eating Europe. Kenny, thanks for joining us, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. It's great to be here.
So when you're in Rome on Christmas time, let's just take a walk together. I mean, for one thing, Italians are really into manger scenes, aren't they?
They are, yeah. And I mean, Rome is so beautiful. The way the city is illuminated at Christmas, the Christmas tree, and it's... The lighting of the Christmas tree is such a big event.
And that's on St. Mark's or St. Peter's Square, right?
St. Peter's Square. And then also, sometimes they have two trees, but yeah.
Okay, because there's a huge one right next to the biggest manger scene I've ever seen on St. Peter's Square at the Vatican in front of St. Peter's Basilica. So right there next to that obelisk, which is like 5,000 years old, is a big tree and also a manger scene. But these Presepi, I think... St. Francis of Assisi was the first guy to use a manger scene as a teaching tool. And the Presepi, they relate to the people who are looking at the Christmas story. And there's baby Jesus and Mary and Joseph and the shepherds and the sheep and the cows. They put it into a local scene so people don't think it's far away in Bethlehem, but it's right here. So you could have snow if you're talking to Eskimos in their Presepi. So you got all these beautiful Tuscany scenes in a Presepi. So when you're in Rome, and this Christmas season goes like for a month, you can step in to any church. It's kind of like open house, isn't it?
Yeah, you can go in any church, see that. I was also going to mention Piazza del Popolo also has a Christmas tree.
Okay.
And that's stunning. And every year, the Romans are waiting to see the unveiling of the Christmas tree. And like I said, when it's lit up. It's...
Yeah. You know, Rome is... It's a big, brutal city, but it's also got a collection of neighborhoods feeling.
And, absolutely.
And people feel part of the neighborhood. I know during COVID, a lot of my friends commented that now we have our piazzas back. And it was actually kind of a blessing not to have any tourists there because people could go to Piazza del Popolo like they did 100 years ago without all the tourism. You could go to Piazza Navona and not have people selling you stuff.
I remember going to Piazza Navona right when they opened up during COVID, and there were like 20 people there. It was incredible. Going to Trevi Fountain, I was one of six. This was right of March 2020.
Oh, man.
It was
amazing. So, well, you're going to have a lot of people on the streets in Rome during Christmas time. And that Christmas season, like throughout Europe, it's a long season. And in Italy, it actually goes longer than most because it goes till Epiphany. That would be January 6th. Why is that in Italy?
Well, in Italy, there's a tradition called La Befana. It's part of the Epiphany tradition.
That's a witch, right?
It's so a witch.
This is that naughty or nice thing.
Yeah. This is kind of for kids in Italy. It's another holiday because that's when, if you've been nice, if you've been a good boy or girl, you're going to get visited by the Befana and you're going to get more presents.
But if you're bad, if you were a bad kid, you're not going to get the presents.
No,
But the witch is a scary character.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah, it's a
scary character. It's Epiphany. That's the 12th day of Christmas, I understand. So that was the day the wise men finally gave the Christ child the gift.
Right.
And Italian kids open up their presents the same day Jesus got them.
Yep.
On Epiphany. Italians love food. I don't need to tell you that. You're on a food tour company. But let's talk a little bit about what food we might encounter when we're in Italy in the winter holiday season.
Well, one thing I love is torrone, which is like a nougat. And there's different kinds. You know, some are chocolate flavored or hazelnut. But torrone, it's a kind of a nougat bar. And
so that's a holiday thing.
Yeah. Because you could find it all year. But
I see it all year, but it doesn't appeal. It doesn't appeal in the summer. But I think it would be good in a cold night out in Rome to have your torrone bar. Panettone, that's something that really goes with the holiday season.
Yeah. What's amazing at Christmas in Rome, the amount of panettone that are bought and sold. Every Christmas party, dinner you're going to, you're receiving, you might get seven different panettone.
Whether you like
Christmas
it or not.
Yeah.
It's kind of a fruit bread, isn't it?
No, it's
fruit
more.
Fruit cake?
No, it's a soft, spongy cake. And nowadays, you really find, you know, some are filled with pistachio, others chocolate, some with like a raspberry. And every store sells it, but the key is to go to a bakery where they bake it in-house. And there you can taste
good.
A really fresh, delicious panettone.
Because if we get panettone here in the States, it's like it's one of these things that last for months.
Yeah,
you know?
All the preservatives. But go to a local kind of acclaimed bakery and get a really good one.
And even if they don't have panettone all year long, most of them will pull out all the Christmas stops and have their panettone.
Yeah.
Panforte also, is that a deal in the holidays?
Yeah, that's also a deal. That's more like what you would call a fruitcake here in the States. It's a much more dense and
maybe
solid.
Maybe that's what I was thinking of. Yeah,
that probably is.
That's
Panforte, Pandoro is the other word.
Pandoro. And of course, we think in the wintertime, we think hot spiced wine in Germany. Would you in Italy, it seems like it'd almost be a sacrilege to take fine Tuscan wine and spice it up. But what happens?
No, you still have your mulled wine. I mean, you know, you're not going to use one of the more expensive.
Brunello Montalcino.
Yeah, it's not going to be a Brunello.
Because they have their Christmas markets just like you tourists all go to in Germany.
Absolutely.
And the nice thing about the Christmas season, as I mentioned in Italy, it goes for an extra 12 days. One thing I was so inspired by once, I was in Trastevere and at the church there on the main square, Santa Maria in Trastevere.
Right.
It's the most beautiful church, and all the pews were gone, and it was filled with tables.
Yeah, they have a Christmas meal, and people, you know, homeless people are...
The poor people
of the neighborhood. Yeah, of the neighborhood are invited there, and it's just they set up all these tables. It's amazing how the church is completely transformed.
I love that.
And here people sit and break bread together and have this beautiful Christmas meal.
Kenny, when I looked at that, I thought there was a lot of loneliness perhaps by a lot of these people who looked like they didn't have a lot of loved ones with them at this time of year. Mm-hmm. But for this moment, they were all brought together in that church that goes back to ancient times, literally.
They say that the first Christian Mass was on that site. I mean, it wasn't in that church that was rebuilt, I believe, in the 12th century, but...
In Trastevere.
In Trastevere,
across the river. So you could get away with those kind of radical things.
Yeah.
If you're going to start up a new religion,
radical.
You can
Absolutely.
Do it across the river, but look out if you come to the other side of the tracks.
Yeah.
It's sort of the wrong side of the tracks kind of thing. Or the action was just over the river.
Exactly.
So this is a walk through Rome, Christmas time. I just love being in Italy in the winter. It's a beautiful thing. You've been for 15 Christmases.
15 years, and I love, I mean, Christmas, the city really transforms. I mean, and every year it feels like in the Centro Storico, in the historic center, the lighting displays, they get more beautiful and more ornate, and every year is a little bit different. There's different themes.
And I got to say, there's a joy and a generosity and a feeling of neighborhood that comes out, I suppose, everywhere. But in Rome, it can be an aggressive city. It just feels people are taking some time, enjoying the moment, and it's a big family.
Absolutely, yeah. Really, there's something very special of that time of year. And I would totally agree with you. Everyone, I mean, people are warm. It's a warm city. You're right. It's fast and maybe a little aggressive. But you're right. Around the holiday times, things do seem to slow down a little bit.
Kenny Dunn, thank you so much. Best of luck with your food touring. And buon Natale.
Buon anno.
Buon Natale, Merry Christmas time in Rome. In St. Peter's Square, the bells ring from the dome.
Last summer, I spent a few days in Venice, not doing research for my guidebook, but on an actual vacation. And naturally, I booked a day with a local guide. I had a delightful time with Igor Scamporin. He joins us now from his home in Italy to share how Venetians get into the spirit of Christmas and New Year's. Igor, Merry Christmas, and thanks for joining us.
Merry Christmas to all of you.
We should say Buon Natale.
Absolutely, Buon Natale a tutti.
Is there a Venetian dialect for Merry Christmas, or is it Buon Natale?
No, it's Buon Natale, actually. We got, of course, a Venetian dialect, but Buon Natale is Buon Natale. And buon anno, happy new year, actually, but it sounds almost the same.
Okay, now how many Christmases have you celebrated in and around Venice?
I don't know, because I've been away for a bit.
Okay,
but say almost all my life, he has been in Venice. That is always super cool, and the atmosphere is just wow.
Tell us, take me on a walk through Venice during this Christmas season. What am I going to see?
The Christmas season is very exciting, especially because on the last few years, they are doing a celebration that is called Glass Christmas. I believe that one of the most interesting things that I saw so far, it was several years ago, that it was a massive Christmas tree next door to the Basilica di San Marco, Mark Basilica, that it was made out of glass. With pipes that they were totally illuminated together with a gigantic star, burning
so
star,
beautiful.
Actually.
Venetian glass.
See, and it's fears that the municipality is giving the chance to the local artists to display their own masterpieces of art that they produce in the island of Murano.
Ah,
that is a
thousand
beautiful years that they do it. But here in Venice, we got a special decoration in St. Mark's Square, and they are doing what? Chandeliers made out of glass to show off the Christmas lights, and that is very interesting.
Now, I know all over Italy, the presepi, the nativity scenes, are a big deal, and every region has its own style of these presepi. What kind of manger scenes might we see in Venice?
And so we do have the presepi, the nativities that are going to be displayed in all the churches, and then in St. Mark's Square. But let's say 2 years ago, we started a new project with Rialto Bridge. And so we would have had a massive projector that it was projecting the scenes of the nativity, Venice with the snow, Venice with the Christmas lights. And that was very cool, actually.
Yeah. Now, I love the music of Venice. This is the city of Vivaldi and so on. What kind of music might we enjoy during the holiday season in Venice?
Almost all the time we do the choir inside of the churches. And pretty much the majority of the locals, they are waiting the mass at midnight because you got the choir with religious Christmas songs, or the 25th of December, we got the other mass that is the most important one in St. Mark Basilica, and that might be pretty exciting and cool.
And when people are traveling around Europe, they like to visit some holiday markets during the Christmas season. Of course, these are very popular in Germany and in the Alps. What kind of a market scene do you have in Venice during the holidays?
And so we got a small market that is situated in San Polo. And right over there, we got a ice skating ring. And for all the locals, it's pretty exciting because having an ice skating ring in Venice is kind of weird. And so
ice skating in Venice, that is weird. Where is that located?
In San Polo, in Campo San Polo. And so we got the big ice skating ring, and that is a kind of cool. It's like New York. Same idea.
That's good. And when you're... when you think about your childhood memories of Christmas in Venice, what kind of food or drink or grandmother's cooking up something for Christmas? What would you look forward to?
Grandmother, there's a long list of things that grandma would cook because she always said, "You have to grow, my little." So, but the thing is, we got something that is called musetto. The musetto, actually, it's a boiled salami, and normally you eat with the puré, and that is one of the most typical ones that you're having during Christmas time. You got the zampone. The zampone actually is the fit pigs that are stuffed with meat, and you boil it, and you do it with the puré. And then, of course, we got the fish, and so... at that time, the fish market for us, you're going to get all the delicacy, especially like eel that you do it stew, or otherwise you got the scallops that normally you clean the muscle, you put it into the shell, you put breadcrumbs, parsley, garlic, salt and pepper, and you bake it in the oven for something like 20 minutes, and the tagliolini with the lobster.
Mmm, lots of treats out right out of the lagoon.
Oh, see.
Yeah. Did you say eel soup?
Eels. Not soup, but it's more like stew. And so basically...
Stew. So you have a long, skinny eel. You cook them up and chop them up and make a stew.
See.
Is it as terrible as it sounds?
No, really, actually.
Is it tasty?
It's super tasty. And it's something that everybody's looking forward to have the eels at the end of the year, actually.
Nice. Okay, and then a few days later, it's New Year's Eve. How do we say that? Buon anno?
Buon anno. So everybody's going to Piazza San Marco. It's like going to Times Square. And normally we do the fireworks right in Piazza San Marco, and that is a cool thing.
Nice. And you've got that Moore's Tower, which is, I think, the world's first digital clock. This is way from the Middle Ages. And you've got the two boys with the big hammers hammering the bell at the top of the tower. And just below that, in two windows, you've got Roman numerals telling what time it is, right?
See, we got, you're right, the first digital clock that we inaugurated in 1510.
1510, it's 500 years old, and it goes in five-minute increments, so you can all gather in front of that at 11:55 and wait for that to turn over. Is that what happens?
If it will be on time, yes, that you know that Italians were always late and they might not be in the mood of playing for the New Year's Eve.
Okay, well, that's one of my goals, to be on St. Mark's Square at midnight, hope the tower is on time, gather with my Venetian friends. Would we have a glass of Prosecco or what would we be drinking?
We will be drinking Prosecco, of course, together with the panettone and the mandorlato, the nougat.
Buon anno.
Buon anno. Auguri.
Right. Igor, mille grazie.
Grazie
and,
a te.
And season's greetings to you. Thank you.
Ciao, grazie mille. Buon anno. Buon Natale.
Buon Natale.
Un altro anno sta passando, finalmente arriverà il Natale. Arrivano messaggi da ogni dove, ma qui c'è bisogno di calore. È meglio stare in compagnia tutti insieme a cantare. Una chitarra, 100 voci ed 1 milione di cuori. E se scartiamo i regali, fuori sta nevicando.
di speciale c'è.
Just in time for the solstice, here are some winter season haiku sent to us by our listeners from the link in the radio section of ricksteves.com. Dana Ivy from New York City paints this landscape. Stark and white beauty, fairyland snow on bare trees, Central Park, New York. Rick Preston of Miramonte, California, describes this scene hiking in Utah's backcountry in this double haiku. Sun on cottonwood, reflections of leaf and sky, the smell of river, moving through canyon, winter light beckons me on, don't know when to stop. While Lisa Trader of Edmonds, Washington, has a more practical concern. The sun is shining, but I still feel a bit chilled. I hate my jacket. Gretchen Williams of Mercer Island, Washington, commemorates surviving her first winter in Europe with this poem. Moving to Munich, our coldest winter ever. Then, beautiful spring.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Kazmira Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Find out more about our guests and listen to a podcast version of the show whenever you like at ricksteves.com/radio.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves. Thanks for listening. In our online travel store, you can choose from 80 different Rick Steves guidebooks covering just about every country, region, and major city in Europe, as well as books on history, art, Italian food, cruising, and festivals, plus phrase books and planning maps. You'll find my favorite bag, the one I designed and I live out of for 100 days a year, and a selection of other custom-designed bags, backpacks and wheeled bags, big and small, plus a selection of accessories that experienced travelers won't leave home without. It's all at ricksteves.com.